Welcome to The Lighthouse Conversations, a podcast featuring entrepreneurs and tastemakers from the world of arts, culture, tech, and of course, food. I'm your host, Hesham Montasser. If you're enjoying the show, please go to your podcast player and hit the subscribe button. You can also tag us on Instagram at thelighthouse_AE and leave us a review. Today's episode comes with a little slice of history. Some of you might not know that this podcast actually started as a physical conversation series at the Lighthouse D3 before it was digitized. And one of our guests we had at the time was Neda Dibs, a designer based out of Beirut whose work spans multiple design forms from furniture to craft to fashion to interiors. On the back of a breakfast conversation Hani and I had with Neda in Beirut, we felt we had so much more ground to cover and promptly invited Neda to come on the show during Design Week. And the rest, as they say, is history.
I look for coming up with a collection that brings out the craft to its best.
We have a small lighthouse gift for you.
Oh,
it's
another pioneering
Arab artist. Thank you so much for coming. And stay
thank
tuned,
you.
We'll be having more events soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Neda has retained her brand's essence through many ups and downs, including the recent explosions in Beirut, the cross-cultural harmony, the hybridity of her own life. She grew up in Japan, studied in Beirut and the US, and now works with regional craftsmen out of Beirut. And most importantly, a timeless aesthetic that, in my opinion, truly embodies a modern Middle East design ethos. I'm going to just start, and this is something we spoke about a little bit in our first conversation, but I think it's worth mentioning again. When we opened the Lighthouse, we were playing around with the kind of a tagline of what our values are and what it represents. And I remember one of the things we talked about is we want the Lighthouse, beyond the food, to embody a kind of contemporary Middle Eastern design aesthetic. When I think of contemporary Middle Eastern design, I think you are always the name that comes to mind to me and to many other people as an inspiration and someone that really led the way. Let's start from the beginning. You grew up in Japan. Can you walk us through a little bit of your upbringing and then move to Lebanon and then how this very particular aesthetic that you have and design philosophy came into place?
Okay, so I grew up in Japan because my family has been... went in 1917. My great uncle traveled down the Silk Route. He arrived to Shanghai, heard of opportunities in Kobe, Japan.
From Lebanon.
Well, at the time there was no Lebanon, so it was Greater Syria.
Greater Syria.
Yeah, so from Greater Syria, from Damascus, went down the Silk Route, and he settled in Kobe, Japan, which is a port city with a lot of international community. And then my other uncle went in the 50s, and then my father went to Japan in 1953 as a young adult of 23 years old.
Not married. Single.
He was single.
Following his family, essentially.
Yes. And, you know, they were trading in textiles, and they came back, my father came back to Beirut, so Beirut then became a thing.
Yeah. What did your father do?
So he was trading in textiles.
Okay.
So, and it's still a family business. And now my brothers are still in Japan taking care of the business. Yeah.
And he met your mother in Beirut.
He met my mother in Beirut, got married. I was born and went to Japan.
And your mother is still in Japan.
My mother's still in Japan.
And then you grew up there and then you came to Beirut to study.
I actually studied business administration. It is not my first choice, but my parents really wanted me to get to know my roots. And, you know, growing up in Japan, I actually was struggling because there was nobody like me. There weren't other Arabs. There weren't other Muslims. So I almost had this kind of shame, you know, like as a child, you want to relate and belong.
100%.
There was no sense of community.
Were there other Arabs or other even, I don't even want to call brown people, but non-Japanese people in the school? Were you like really completely alone?
Yeah, well, you know, we had a lot of Europeans and Americans.
Okay.
We had some Asians. The other community that I could relate to culturally was the Indian community, because the Indian community, you know, their parents were conservative. They were a bit strict. They weren't as loose in their upbringing of girls. So, you know, it was... it was very much a community I related to, but in my particular school, they were mostly Europeans and Americans. They were taller than me, and they were, a lot of them were children of missionaries. So they were there to, convert the Japanese people into either, Catholicism or Protestant.
Like many other missionary schools around the world.
Yeah.
And what was your coping mechanism with that? I mean, how did you deal with that? Did you just go inwards? Or did you try to connect in different ways? How did you deal with it?
I think I went inwards, very much of an introvert, very shy, very quiet. And, it was really tough. And I think I actually used to do a lot of drawings and coloring. And, I used to go home and color.
That was one of your ways.
That was my ways. Yeah, I loved painting and coloring and building. And I loved working with my hands.
But yet you went to business school.
I went to business. I didn't have much choice because my parents wanted me to go to the American University of Beirut only. No other university in Beirut. And they didn't have this department of design. Yeah. Or
which eventually became a very well-known department.
Yes.
In the Middle East.
Yeah.
Did they insist on you going to AUB because they were hoping to indoctrinate you in Lebanese ways? Or was it maybe you'll meet a significant person? I mean, what was the rationale?
So I was their kind of guinea pig, Okay. I'm the first child. And I went to, they wanted me to meet my husband, my future husband. And they thought if I stayed in Japan, I'd end up with a Japanese man. They were worried. If I went to America, I'd go off the wrong track.
Sort of the typical Arab.
Typical
concept.
Arab mentality. They changed their mind with my siblings.
But they always do. The first one is always,
I know,
hard.
So it was really a blessing in disguise, I have to say. But at that time, I was very angry at them. Like, how would you send me to Lebanon? It's war. And even my classmates were surprised that my parents made that choice.
Yeah, and at this point, you've sort of probably somewhat cracked the Japanese code finally. And there you go to a completely foreign place now, essentially to you, right? Without the language.
Without the language.
You don't really know the culture.
Without the culture.
Yeah. And you're sort of thrown into the deep end.
Yes. And I really was thrown into the deep end to the point as simple as I would meet some friends and they say, Bukra, we're going to the beach. So Bukra means the future. But for me, Bukra meant tomorrow. So I'd have everything prepared and pack my beachwear and, it turns out, no, Bukra is like...
Arab Bukra, yeah.
Yeah. In a way, I was actually very happy because I was in the dorms. I spoke English. And so there was a side of me where, side of the people that were a bit like upset with me that I spoke English, like, don't you speak your Arabic language? Like, why are you showing off? So I had this kind of...
Yeah. They didn't understand. Yeah, they thought
attack.
It was sort of an element of showing off as opposed to...
Yeah, but at the same time, they would wonder, who's this young girl who has come from... I was 17. I was very young. Who's this young girl who just came from, Asia, all the way from Japan? So they also were like wondering and they were curious. So I made a lot of friends. And it just opened up this whole world of... Arabs who were like me, and they're modern, they're not conservative, and so that reminded me of how important it is to have this sense of belonging, So this was like the first trigger of like, I think I was kind of like a very quiet, almost depressed child, But when I went to AUB...
You flourished.
I flourished, I was like, I'm being celebrated. Yes, maybe I spoke English. And some of the people didn't like that. But, I felt like I was with a community. So that was huge for me.
And what's so interesting is you developed this appreciation for roots and for belonging, but you also used that hybridity and brought it back into your practice eventually, right?
Yes.
I mean, my immediate reaction to seeing your work in the early days when I first time I went to Beirut, was that amazing hybridity of this sort of Japanese aesthetic and clean lines and minimalism married with mostly Middle Eastern materials. And you did this beautiful, they came together in such a complementary way that was really, for someone like myself, quite eye-opening. How did that develop?
That was all really subconscious. So I remember as a child, I used to always say, okay, we had different religions, we have different nationalities. And, you know, I always was like, there must be something in common. Why are we so different from everyone else? For example, like we had a lot of like Arab Jews who were in Japan. Some of them held the Israeli nationality. But, you know, we spoke the same language. We had the same culture. And I'm like, wait, but, you know, I didn't see the national differences. You know, I wanted that one common element. So that was the constant question that I had. So eventually I arrived to Lebanon 20 years ago, and I look around to see what is Middle Eastern furniture. And I realized that it was stuck from 200 years ago, furniture made for the Ottoman, made in the Ottoman Empire.
Can you just pause for a second before we get to that? Because you needed the skills to be able to express this sentiment. How did you acquire the skill? Because it's not just, I could have the sentiment today. It doesn't mean I can express it.
Yeah.
What brought you to the point where you were confident to be able to use this sentiment that you're, I think, about to talk about and actually express it in terms of your craftsmanship and your workmanship? What was there before? Did you study it? Did you?
Yes. So, yes, I did study. So after the business.
After the AUB experience.
So AUB times was very difficult because every year or every semester, every other semester, we'd have to escape the country because, you know, either there's strikes or, I mean, it was not a very stable time. So finally, I did graduate, and this time I wanted to study interior design or interior architecture.
You knew that's what you wanted to do. Did anyone in your family do interior or
nobody.
Architecture?
Nobody. So my family is completely business-oriented.
Yeah,
they're commerce,
trading.
They sell meters, hundreds of thousands of meters of fabric. They had no idea what it means to design, you know, the word design, even for me. But I knew I wanted to do that. So I applied to the Rhode Island School of Design,
School of Design globally.
Yeah, and which I really, really, I think it was really the passport to my.
So that craftsmanship was taught at RISD essentially.
I studied interior architecture, but there was one course in furniture design, which I, when I looked back a few years ago, I realized I got an A+ in it, and I had no idea.
I'm surprised.
Yeah. So at that time, the teacher John Dunnigan, I still remember. He gave us like this a word, and we had to take this word and transform it into a piece of furniture. And I found myself going to all these different workshops and look at materials, and then I found a way to bring. So basically, he gave me the word light. Light could mean heavy and light, and it could also mean see through or visual light. And so I found a way where I can combine those two meanings in one piece. And so it's really about finding that common element, or compromising, or finding that common element between those two words, two meanings. And I made a piece of furniture out
what
of
piece?
That.
That was your first piece?
It was my first
what
piece.
Was
so
it?
Basically, it's a table, side table, that is held by transparent plexiglass legs.
God, I feel I have to see this table.
Yeah, and the top is an opaque granite top. And what's in between that holds it all together, because it's detachable, was a steel
frame
that is reflective.
Wow.
Right? So one is opaque, one is reflective, one is transparent.
Wow.
And one is light, medium
weight. And this
was
right after you graduated.
This was one of the furniture
your graduation
courses.
Thesis, essentially.
Yeah, one of my courses, yeah. So that was like, looking back, I seem to have this knack for actually finding a balance between, you know, words or unexpected things. And I seem to
words,
do that.
Cultures, East and
yeah,
West, I mean,
exactly,
all of that comes
time, into old and new.
What's so interesting to me, Sio, I mean, you know, the concept of Arabs or people that grew up in this region, or even didn't grow up in the region, but like you went back to the region and then went to the States or Europe to study is relatively common, let's say. They learn typically kind of in Western schools of thought, Western design, if you talk about art and design. And they many times go back home and practice that. And they use what they've learned to practice that contemporary language they're using is language they've learned there. You know, and I'm one of those people that went to the States for many years and came back and used that. What's so fascinating about what you've done is you've crafted, to me, seemingly almost from the beginning, your own design language. So one thing to say, you know what? These guys are doing a lot of very contemporary stuff. We're still stuck in the Middle Ages. Let me create contemporary furniture or contemporary designs. But you've almost seemingly from the beginning had a code or a language, a very particular style, that merged these two. That's usually something that I would have imagined would have happened 10, 20 years in your practice. How did that start right away, that kind of combo?
You know, it's so subconscious, all of it. Okay, so after RISD, I worked a bit in the States. And then I moved to London because I was looking, I was also on this search of finding my roots and having this sense of belonging. So in the States, there was no sense of community.
Hard, yeah.
So London, I knew there was an Arab community that spoke English, you know. This, in the UK in the 90s, this was where I started to appreciate. I would go around to furniture stores and I would see that everything was about the antique. It wasn't the contemporary furniture time, you know, the very cool furniture that today they have in the UK did not exist in that time. And it was actually recession time.
There was no Conran shop yet?
There was a Conran shop. I think there, yes, there was a Conran. It was early days.
Yeah.
Habitat, there was Habitat.
Just starting.
Just starting, yeah. And it was, and but you visit places, Harrods or wherever you go, and antique places, and they would talk about, you know, Louis says, 18th century, the carving, and they pointed out all the this gilded. Beautiful work. And I got to know about David Linley's cigar, you know, like his cigar boxes and how they use marquetry. So I started to become very interested in craft. It just, and there was this sense of sophistication in craft, and knowing that things that are crafted over time goes up in value, whereas things that are made, you know, mass-produced, they don't go up in value.
There's a timelessness to that.
Yeah, there's a timelessness to it. So, you know, all this was going into my subconscious. So a few years later, you know, maybe 9 years later, I moved to Lebanon, finally hoping that I will, you know, get to the core of where I'm originally from. And I find that I'm actually not fully Lebanese. And I looked around to see what is Middle Eastern furniture, and there was no such thing. They were still antiques. Stuck, yeah, like these beautiful antique mirrors.
All the homes were essentially antique. And
yeah, I mean, they would, or even contemporary homes, the way they would have contemporary Italian, French, Belgian furniture, and then they would bring in an old Middle Eastern mirror,
correct.
You know, a Damascus mirror or a chest of drawers. And it's beautiful. That combination, the contrast is beautiful. And there was Artisan du Liban. But for me, I was really interested in furniture making. Yeah. And there were no furniture designers. No university taught furniture design at the time. Today they do. And in a way, so there was this open canvas for me to experiment with. And I was actually, you know, I just went to see how the craft was done, and they didn't have the craft. The craft I was looking for was based in Damascus. So I took a trip to Damascus, and I saw this workmanship, and I saw the pride these workmen had. You know, one of the guys, he had these golden teeth, you know, smiling, so proud of what he...
Until today, I
Till
to
today,
say,
they are. They have so much pride in what
so
they
much
do.
Pride in what they do.
But then I would look at the end product, and I would imagine the type of people like me, and saying, okay, we like it, but, you know, we can't relate to it. You know, this is not something I can put in my home. So I thought, how can I take that beautiful craft and apply it in a new way? And it was automatic for me.
Reinterpreted, essentially.
Reinterpreted. Automatic for me to just remove all the
frills
exactly,
yeah.
And get down to the essence.
Yeah.
And this is Japanese philosophy. So the Japanese, you know, they say less is more, they say Zen. But basically, it's really removing all the frills, all the excess, and getting down to the essence of, you know, what is the meaning of this craft or this piece or this function? You know, just enough information to let you know, understand what it is. And so I use that with the Middle Eastern craft. So all of a sudden, all these curvy Louis XIV chairs or the curvy mirrors have become rectilinear and simple. And what stood out was the craft. So I highlighted the craft. And that is really, in essence, what I do, is I never think about the form of the piece when I'm designing. I take a craft, and I see what form I can create to highlight that craft.
Yet the pieces are highly functional.
Yes.
So that's the interesting part. So, I mean, I have some of your pieces. We spoke about this. Some of the trays from, I don't know, 15 years ago. Some of the plexi tables, which are multifunctional. One, they're timeless. Two, the quality. Actually, they age better. So every year, they look more beautiful than the year before. But thirdly, which is something that I found not as easy to find, a lot of times there's a beauty in how they look, but then the functionality lacks. That's not the case. And that's also very Japanese, where... and German, frankly, in terms of design, where you have this high functionality, but it's married with this beauty.
So it also is very American, if you really think of it.
That's true.
You know, I always use this parallel where, just like my family went down the Silk Route to get to Japan, you know, in the Silk Route, people trade ideas and craft techniques. So, you know, like silk went to Venice, glass blowing went to Bohemia. You know, so there was a lot of exchange of ideas. So in a way, you know, growing up in Japan, living in the States, Europe, and coming back to Lebanon, you have all these different aesthetics that I picked up along the way. And when you think of America, what's really interesting is it's a brand new country, 200 years old. And when the settler, the pilgrims that went and settled there, everything was back to basics. So everything is about practicality, right? And so in a way, and I also have parents, and it does come from my Japanese upbringing of the no-nonsense, you know? Like, you know, why are you creating that piece? What's the point, you know? So, yes, so I'm always asking those questions. So they better be practical pieces, you know? They better be useful, not just a decorative piece. So I grew up with a no-frills mentality.
Yeah, that whole Dieter Rams as well, sort of minimalism.
Yeah.
We'll be right back to talk about Nara's collaboration with mega brands such as IKEA and her love for anime. Yes, that's Japanese anime, right after this short break. I wanted to take a minute and tell you about our friends at Monviso, one of our sponsors who make this show possible. Monviso is founded by an Italian entrepreneur right here in Dubai and has evolved into one of the region's most popular mineral waters sourced directly from the Italian Alps. We immediately connected with the Monviso's team vision and how giving back is such an integral part of their mission. Through their extensive recycling program and their Take Water, Give Life initiative, proceeds from every bottle of water sold is donated to Al Jalila Foundation to support its education and research. So stock up on still or mineral water by using our exclusive Monviso discount code, Lighthouse10, which you can redeem at store.monviso.com. Once again, the code is Lighthouse10, Lighthouse10. Welcome back. You're listening to the Lighthouse Conversations with our guest, Nada Dibs. You have worked with huge brands. I mean, IKEA is one.
Yes, that's right.
You worked with a number of Italian shoemakers, is that right? I remember.
Fratelli Rossetti.
Exactly,
we did
Rossetti.
Sandals, limited edition sandals with them.
Were you not intimidated to go, you know, if I'm collaborating with an IKEA or Rossetti or one of those big brands, Louis Vuitton, etc. I'm saying, oh my God, like my brand is going to get diluted. But you seem to do it with a lot of confidence.
It's funny because...
Am I right?
Yeah, actually it does appear that way. I'm just doing what I'm doing, but then it appears that all of these collaborations come from this, not a childhood, but like a dream, you know? All of them were dreams. Like, I've always loved shoes and I've always loved heels. And when Mr. Rossetti himself visited our studio in Beirut, he saw I had all these heels that I had experimented with. And he's like, you seem to love shoes. And I said, yes, my dream was to design for a big brand. But I forgot that he was Mr.
So he's like, I'm the big brand.
Yeah, I'm a big brand. And he's like, would you like to? So he was very inspired by my passion for these shoes because I had all these heels and I kept bringing some under my desk. Same with IKEA. IKEA, I was you know, that I wanted to actually, when I moved to Beirut, I actually wrote them a letter. At the time, I think it was a letter or a fax, you know. We didn't have email.
Like,
I wrote them,
Dear
IKEA, yeah. I would really like to represent you in Lebanon. Would you please consider
Call me?
Me? I'm an
fax me back.
Can you fax me back? I studied at Rhode Island School of Design.
Yeah.
I'm
an up and coming designer.
Yeah, and so I did send, and I do have a letter from them saying, unfortunately, we already have someone who represents Lebanon, but thank you for asking. And so I still have that piece of letter.
And then how many years later did you wind up collaborating with them?
20 years.
20 years
Almost
later.
Almost 20 years later.
Did you go back and show them this letter?
No, but I should.
You should.
I should show them this letter.
It says something about them that they actually bothered to answer
you back. I did tell, I told the one colleague that I worked with. But yeah, so for me, I used to go to IKEA. It was a very small shop in Kobe that they opened. And that was a trip I used to love to go to, you know. So that goes back 30 years, even more. So everything that's manifested today are little dreams I had. And even my shyness, like, so I follow my own little path, but I think what's happening is that a lot of people are relating to what I feel. You know, now there's this the idea of duality, really.
Oh, 100%.
No one is actually one way anymore. I mean, and look at Dubai, it's a perfect example.
The point I was making earlier, the lighthouse was a direct result of hybridity. And a lot of that hybridity I saw in your work. There's a reason once you put your mirrors up, which were designed for sale, we never took them down.
I know.
And
it's
now
so
they
nice.
Become part of the lighthouse, right?
Yeah.
I put that, everybody's like, well, no, people are buying them. No, we're going to keep them.
That's so nice, yeah.
And it, you know, because that hybridity was very much at the essence of our brand when we started. I felt that, you know, I had obviously grew up in Cairo and lived abroad, lived in the US and then the UK for a while and came back and wanted to do something with food and design that encapsulated all of those things. Went to a German school as well. So there are all these
amazing
elements.
Amazing, yeah.
And that hybridity, I figured there's enough people that would be interested in it. And I think your work is very much that, or a different manifestation of that. And that market is actually much larger than we think.
Yes.
Almost all of us, many of us, have that hybridity. Dubai is essentially a case in point, right?
I know, it's amazing.
It doesn't get any more hybrid than that.
Yeah, and you know, of course, we all retain our essence of who we are. Like, you know, we're Arabs. We're dressed in modern clothing.
Yes.
You know, like that's how I translate that into furniture. So the form is quite pure and simple, but you feel there's an element, and which is craft, which is our heritage.
You seem that all during all this time to very much believe in not just Arab craftsmanship. I remember having this conversation with you where you insisted on doing all the work in the region, in Beirut or in Syria or in Damascus.
In the region, yeah.
And that was very important to you. Talk to us a little bit about that. Why this was important to you. Why didn't you at some point say, you know what? I'm not a dibs. I have these beautiful designs. Frankly, I'll be very honest, I can outsource the manufacturing to, you know, somewhere else, right? And it'll be a lot cheaper and I still have my design stamp, which is what many global brands do. Talk us through that thinking.
Every single business consultant tells me to go out.
Yeah, of course. Higher
and
margins,
yes,
you know.
And I don't know why I have such a strong...
visceral reaction
against
it. Yeah,
a reaction against it. Maybe it's because I work a lot with our craftspeople and I just cannot let them go. I can't abandon them.
Well,
they're
passionate.
You
could,
yeah.
You could keep some lines that you do there and do the majority of it abroad and kind of higher volume, but you didn't do that. And you and I had this conversation three years ago over breakfast. Honestly, I'll be very honest with you. In many ways, I salute you for that, but it is definitely not the smart business decision necessarily. So is it, you feel you want to give back? Is it the craftsmanship that you're holding on to, the identity?
I mean, when I look around, like let's say Hermès, you know, in France, okay, they can also probably manufacture in other...
And they
but
don't.
They don't.
They don't.
And, you know, maybe to make it simple, basically I want to aim to be the Hermès of the Middle East.
Bottega doesn't either.
Yeah. So for me, because I grew up not so proud of who I am, I found that it's actually, but I felt so that belonging is so important. And also preserving our heritage is actually preserving ourselves. If we compromise on that, we compromise on our heritage.
That's and admirable. We lose it. I agree.
And so someone has to do it, right? If other people want to make money out of it, okay. But me, for me, okay, yes, it's important to sustain the business.
Oh,
I have
course,
to make money.
It's commercial business, but I don't feel that's at the essence of what you do. It's that value system that drives you. It's obvious.
Yeah. It's so important for me, and I can't let go of my craftsmen. And actually, even now, I'm working on a mapping furniture maker mapping in Tripoli, in the north of Lebanon, because it's where a lot of the furniture makers are, and they're all, you know, they have no work.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing a very, I've hired someone doing a special mapping exercise to see what crafts they do, their motivation level, if they're willing to work, if I bring them work. You know, I still want to keep trying.
And I think it's very important to highlight this point. I can't emphasize enough that I'm not sure all the people appreciate that you're doing that. I understand that you've held on to this despite the pressures. And frankly, it also shows in terms of the quality of what's produced.
Thank you.
I mean, I've seen your work now for a long time, and I have some of your work, and I know.
I do have people, factories. Like, I've visited some factories here in Dubai, and they're like, oh, yes, the CNC machine can do that. I said, yes, probably. But I actually try to make objects that the machines cannot do.
Yeah.
So I, you know, the carving would be around at the bottom of a thing or on a curved surface, which is much more difficult to work on. So I try to find ways where there's a benefit to having, you know, craftsmen.
And the energy that those products carry, I feel, is also important.
Yeah.
And something you, I think, really believe in. And we've had this conversation. I actually remember about it maybe a year and a half or two ago when we sat at some point and you told me something about, and I wasn't at the time really focused on that. And you said, no, but you know, because this person has good energy. And I started paying more attention to it. And then if you recall, I spoke to you about this again in my home with my wife, with May. And I was like, you know, no, that's right. So you've always had this, you were very attentive to energy. Walk us through that. Is that coming again from sort of a Japanese upbringing, or is that just Netherlands?
Yeah, I would say yes. So remember, you were asking me how I was when I was a child, you know,
yeah.
Very quiet. So I was very much of a listener. You know, I would like to listen to what people say, observe. And, you know, in Japan, it's not what you say that counts. It's what you don't say. And that there's a freedom to that, which
definitely
is beautiful. But when it comes to craft, you know, when you cook for someone you love,
yeah,
and the food is so good.
Nefes.
Okay,
yeah.
How do you explain that? You know, you cannot. It's just there. We can't see it, but it's there. And I think, like,
it's similar.
Okay, my furniture is, you know, there's a lot of beautiful furniture out there. But I see that people are drawn to what I do. Sometimes it's partly the intricate geometry that I work with. But I think it's also the nefes. It's the energy of that craftsman.
100%.
And what is this energy? It's really attention, right? And what is attention? It's love. So when they say labor of love, it's really a labor of love. It's and so when you're cooking with love, you know. And so love is a really beautiful word. I mean, not the love of I love you, but, you know, it's a real love.
that's lovely too, but
yeah,
I get what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, this is true love. And so what people feel, I think, when they see that intricate workmanship is that energy of that craftsman. And because I do see people walking through the showroom and going to touch it, you know, like they want to go touch and feel. And so they're drawn, you know, who makes them want to draw there? I think it's this silent energy. So I'm very much that there's a spiritual aspect to craftsmanship. And you see it also with the Sufis. You see a lot of carpet makers and scarf makers in India and Persia. A lot of them are Sufis, and they use that as part of their meditation. So I think the more craft we do, the happier people will be, the more peaceful people will be. You know, it's just a bigger philosophy than, you know, just a piece of furniture.
Did that help you during the recent events in Beirut? I mean, obviously Beirut went through a terrible time, to put it very mildly.
still.
The explosion.
still going through.
Sorry, absolutely.
Yeah.
The explosion, the essential bankruptcy. Your showroom, amongst many others, was destroyed. How did you cope with that? Was that part of your coping mechanism?
My coping mechanism was to keep going, stand up immediately. I mean, next day we were already starting to restore the windows.
Many people.
But
where do you think that comes from? It almost feels like the Germans after the World War, you know what I mean? That they immediately just went to reconstructing. And look at where they are today, so maybe there's hope.
Yeah, I didn't want to betray my craftsmen. And they're not just mine, you know, I outsource also. I just did not want to, I don't know if that's the right word, betray, but I didn't have the heart to just pick up and leave. You know, like, they're the ones, you know, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be inspired. I mean, my work is inspired by them. So for me, it was so important that I keep going. And, you know, it's been really positive even in Europe. You know, we're not only received in the Middle East very nicely, but also in Europe, they're starting to see the beauty in what we do. And so this is something that, you know, I'm very, very keen on, you know, because when I first arrived to Lebanon, people were always thought about importing. You know, we were kings of import. You know, we have every brand in Lebanon.
I remember that. It was very interesting. Everything. Because the Gulf always had that, but the rest of Arab countries didn't, but Beirut always did. You'd find brands, Cartel before anyone had it.
Yes.
Ketal before anyone had it, et cetera.
So I thought, what is exported from our part of the world? Like, what is so for me, the idea of exporting, and that's where the identity issue became a thing. You know, what do we want to export? You know, partly modern, partly traditional.
Has it mattered that you're a woman doing this to you? And in terms of any challenges or obstacles you've faced? Because ultimately, I mean, you know, this is a region that hasn't necessarily always seen women succeed in their businesses. You go and you're telling people what to do, and craftsmen that are probably mostly men. Yeah. The word craftsman comes for a reason. Has that ever been something you think about or not?
No, actually, I haven't thought about it so much. I think
the
opposite.
I'm just curious.
I mean, I think it's important for certain people, maybe in the corporate world.
Yes.
But in my field, they just the craftsmen just appreciated that I was there with them. You know, like it was more about connecting.
Yeah, there is respect for what you do, and I don't think the sex matters necessarily.
It didn't matter. I think maybe there's respect for women in general. I feel. You know,
I think there is respect for women, but there's also, I was going to get to the point of also in terms of being a role model, because I think that's important because again, I mean, we have very few role models as it is, let alone female role models.
I know. So this is something that I've come to learn about myself because, you know, wisdom creeps up on you. So at the beginning, we're sitting and learning and suddenly you're actually teaching and it's very subtle. It's subtle. Now I do feel, because now there's a big new generation of designers in the region, and a lot of them come to me and say, Nada, you've paved the way for us. And 100%. I'm like, oh, I did? I don't remember. Like, I didn't think of it as such.
That's probably okay.
And to me, that's like huge. And that's one of the reasons I couldn't also stop after the blast. Like, if these young generation... I've been creating this role model and I've paved the way. If I stop, what will happen to them? You know, as a leader in a way in this field. And so for me, this sense of obligation to keep going. But I mean, I'm not doing it because I'm obligated. I'm actually happy doing it. But it really is, you know, it just... My role has shifted.
Well, to be very honest with you, Nada, I mean, it's a lot of things that now people talk about almost in marketing terms that have become slogans that honestly you've been doing all along and maybe not calling them that. And that's much, much better and much more effective in my book. Now, we do have to talk about it because I think it's important that awareness is there. As I was saying earlier, it's important that people that either buy your products or support your work, etc., and understand what goes into it, that you are supporting craftsmanship and so on. But I think that a lot of times today, we're starting to see all of those sort of slogans come out and in a lot of big global brands. because they're on the defensive, because they weren't practicing this for many, many years.
Right.
Right? Whereas you've got it the right way around, which is was always the case.
It was always the case,
And it's very natural to you. This is not something you've discovered, oh my God, no, we shouldn't be exploiting children, so let me not stop doing these practices. No, it was the other way around.
Yeah.
You know, that's always been the case, but I think it needs to also be highlighted because it paves the way for others and because it's such an important contribution.
Yeah. Thank you. That's really nice. But we kind of like we haven't found the right term, but I would say like authentic luxury is something that we, you know, some terms that, because it is what we do is such intricate work. It is luxury at the end of the day, but it comes from an honest place and authentic place.
You were contemplating a few things that you're working on. Can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming projects and what you're focused on?
So for me, I feel like in order to preserve the craft right now in the Middle East, I need to actually bring work to these craftsmen. And, you know, my happy face in Dubai is trying to I feel like my next phase in my life is to actually spend more time in Dubai and maybe do more collaborations with brands express the value of craft. Because I think we're not there yet here.
No, we're not. And you're the perfect ambassador.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, maybe if I say Hermes of the Middle East, it makes it easier for people to understand.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah,
sadly,
I wouldn't like to, but it's okay. I don't mind.
Okay.
But the idea is to really just be aware that it really represents who we are. It's not just about, oh, we want the same look. It's really appreciating ourselves. And so what I'm doing is I work a lot with interior designers and architects, and I will, every visit, and I choose not to do it in large scale. I like one-on-one conversations,
bespoke
conversations, explaining how important it is to preserve our heritage, to keep the craftsmen going, and to create something of our own identity. And I kind of call it neo-Arabian furniture, you know, like, because there's nothing like that look, you know. It's a hybrid look, like you're saying.
It is definitely a hybrid. Is there any, on a more playful note, any particular piece that you've fell in love with more than others? Like, do you have favorites? Like, you know, some people have favorites with their children. You're like, oh, you know, this is my go-to piece.
So I've created this. I think my piece that I'm very proud of is it's a bar unit called Now and Zen. And instead of being inspired by the rectilinear minimalistic forms of Japan, when you look at Japan today, it's all about manga and anime and, you know, the crazy fantasy and the colors. And what I really love about, so I spent a year, before I even knew I was going to do this collection, I spent a year, actually I would avoid going to dinners and I would just go home and watch anime. One film a night for about a year.
As an inspiration or subconscious?
Just subconscious. I needed to connect to Japan, home, and listen to the Japanese language and understand where Japan has come. Has reached. And so then I started to do some research on, you know, what's the philosophy behind anime. And so one of it is really, it's about fantasy, because, you know, if you don't have blue eyes and long purple hair, you can have that in an anime. If it's also a lot of it, and which is I'm drawn to, is that the stories are very spiritual. So they always talk about the other world, or, you know, the past life, or, you know, they have their in their language and their culture, it's just right there. And to me, that intrigues me. And the third thing is, very often there's a female heroine in the film. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do a kind of feminine collection. So I took Mother of Pearl and I stained it in all these rainbow colors. And so I created a kind of like a collection really inspired by that crazy modern geishas wearing the crazy heels and, you know, mini kimonos. And so that to me is like, means a lot, because I was able to adapt something very contemporary into furniture.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening to the Lighthouse Conversations with me, Hashim Montasser. We're produced by Chirag Desai, and our content director is Farhash Sharif. Make sure not to miss any future episodes by following the Lighthouse Conversations in your favorite podcast player like Apple, Google, Spotify, or Anghemi, among others. We'll be back in 2 weeks.